This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. The 2002 film Minority Report has Tom Cruise as its star, and he stars as a cop in a special unit that harnesses psychic powers to predict and prevent crimes.
Look at me. Positive for Howard Marks. I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Duman that was to take place today, April 22nd. It's 0800 hours and 4 minutes.
No!
Did you catch that? He was arrested for the future murder. While that technology remains Hollywood fantasy, the Chicago Police Department has a new system to identify those at the highest risk of being involved in violent crime. This system uses computers rather than psychics. And some residents of Chicago have been getting visits from police officers, but it's not because they've done anything wrong. Joining us now by phone is Matt Stroud. He writes for The Verge, and he recently looked into this program. Welcome to All Sides, Matt.
Thanks very much for having me.
The Chicago Police Department calls it a heat list. How is it compiled, and how do you get on it?
No one quite knows how you get on it, but it is compiled. I guess the process starts at the Illinois Institute of Technology with a professor named Mr. Wernick, Dr. Wernick. And he came up with an algorithm that used crime statistics in Chicago. Miles Wernick is his name. I'm sorry, I blanked there for a second. He uses crime statistics as a way to show, as a way to create an algorithm that will show which 400 residents out of the city's 3 million people are most likely to be involved in a violent incident. I asked him quite a bit about what goes into producing that algorithm, but he wasn't comfortable sharing that information. The rub here a little bit is that going beyond that algorithm, the Chicago Police Department can also make its own determinations beyond what the algorithm shows them about who should be on that list. So there are really a lot of questions here.
Yeah, I mean that's really kind of, I mean, in some ways that you can understand why it's like hotspots, trying to find areas of the city where crime is more likely to occur. So it's sort of one step beyond that, correct?
That's right.
So. What prompted this? Chicago, we all know, has had a terrible, terrible run of homicides and shootings, and you can see how the police are willing to try anything to try to prevent those types of crimes. Is that what's prompted this?
I think that was part of it. The National Institute of Justice put out a call a few years back and said that they were willing to fund predictive policing programs all over the country, and that all they needed was a really good proposal to do that in a city. And Chicago obviously had a lot of reason to want to do something like that. They have a notorious murder rate in the city, and they have a lot of interest in technology going back years and years, as well as superintendents who have run the police department there who have been very much behind using technology as a way to deter crime. And so they apparently put together a really good proposal and got a lot of funding, and they were in fact the one police department, including being chosen above New York City, being chosen above Los Angeles Police Department, to get this funding and to work on this program. And so they've been at work on this program since 2009 and are finally this year willing to talk about what they've done.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson. We're speaking with Matt Stroud. He is a writer with The Verge. And we're talking about Chicago using computers and algorithms to try to predict who is most at risk for committing a violent crime. Matt, you tell the story of a young man who got a visit from a police officer. Describe what happened there.
Robert McDaniel is the kid's name. He lives in a neighborhood of the city called Austin. And just one day, a police officer and a social worker showed up at his front door. It's important to note that police officers aren't showing up at people's door to arrest them. What they're doing is they're showing up and they're having a conversation with those people and saying, listen, we have this heat list. You're on this heat list. We believe that there's a possibility you might end up in a violent situation sometime soon, in a shooting, maybe even a homicide. So we want you to be aware that we're going to be looking after you. And if you want to take advantage of any social services, we are happy to help you find those social services. And so that's what happened to Robert.
He hadn't done anything wrong, correct?
He hadn't done anything wrong in this situation. He has a little bit of a rap sheet. His rap sheet includes, I guess he has a domestic charge, and he had a couple charges for drugs, for marijuana, and he had a couple charges for gambling. But I don't believe any of those actually turned into convictions. So he was arrested on a couple of occasions, but I think he only ended up in lockup for a short period of time. But nothing recent had happened that would suggest that police officers should show up at his door.
So is that part of the equation? You said the professor didn't want to get into the details of the algorithm, but his police record, what is that part of the things that this formula is looking at? What other things is it looking at?
I think it's solely looking at police records. There are other parts of this program. The CPD's program goes beyond this heat list. This is just one part of what they're doing. There's another part of the heat list that looks into 911 calls, looks into calls for service, and tries to predict whether or not crimes are going to happen in certain areas based on those 911 calls and calls for service. That program is a little bit less advanced than the heat list. So the heat list is the one that the Chicago police is willing to talk about.
292-8513 is our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about predictive policing, trying to get folks before they commit a crime, which sounds like science fiction. It was the subject of a science fiction movie, but Chicago police are using computers to try to do just that. What's been the reaction of people in Chicago to this?
I think people who support law enforcement generally, and who believe that that police officers are out to do good, believe that they should be trusted in this situation. I mean, they've put a lot of money and a lot of effort into trying to figure out how to stem the murder rate in Chicago, and in a lot of ways they've been successful. Whether or not it has to do with this program in particular. I mean, last year, Chicago had its lowest murder rate in quite a while, lowest number of murders in quite a while. So from that perspective, I think there are a lot of people who support this and who support this as technology helping to move policing forward. But there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, this really steps beyond the role that police should be playing, because it's... I made a request to get the heat list itself. That request was denied. I've done my best to try to appeal that and get the heat list itself. But from what I'm hearing, you know, a very large percentage of the people who are on that list are African American and Latino, and almost all of the people on that list, again from what I'm hearing, come from some of the city's poorest neighborhoods, and so that brings into question, I guess, the kind of data that's being put into that algorithm and what the ultimate purpose of that data is. Is it subjecting poor and minority groups to surveillance that they don't deserve?
We're speaking with Matt Stroud, a writer from The Verge, about Chicago's predictive policing program, which is using computers and algorithms to try to prevent crime by targeting folks at risk of committing violent crimes, they say, here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's drawing comparisons to the National Security Administration and you know, Edward Snowden and snooping on phone calls and things like that. Are those complaints being heard at City Hall and in the police headquarters?
They are. In an interview with a few police officers who were in charge of this program, I mentioned that myself, and there was everybody in the room said, no, it's nothing like that. And I tend to agree that this isn't to the extent of the NSA. It's not like everybody's information is being collected by the Chicago Police Department, at least for this heat list, and at least from what we can determine. Again, the heat list comes from crime data only. Mm-hmm. So your information only becomes a part of what they're looking at if you get arrested. And if you get arrested, Whether or not you're convicted, the Chicago Police Department believes that you're fair game. And that makes it a little bit different than what the NSA is doing, but it's still there are still questions here.
You say you can't get the list of names that are on this list, and I guess that it kind of makes sense in that these folks have not committed a crime, at least not committed a crime that would put them on the list per se. But is there any way of measuring success? I mean, do they know that, okay, number 242 on the list turned himself around or turned herself around is now, you know, seeing a social worker every week and going to school? How do they know if this is working from a success point of view?
Well, they've only contacted about 50 people on the heat list so far. And there are examples, there are anecdotal examples of people who have been contacted through the heat list and who are now talking with social workers. And there are also examples of people who were contacted from the heat list and who then went on to commit crimes. I'm not sure how you, I mean, there are going to be anecdotal examples either way. So I'm not sure what, the Chicago Police Department would point to say that this particular program works. It's up in the air, and I don't have an answer for that.
And there's no, likewise, there's no evidence to, there's no way of knowing if it, if something failed, where they, you know, improperly contacted somebody or, you know, the line from the movie Minority Report says the system is never wrong until it comes after you. So, I mean, how do you know if it's wrong at some point, I guess?
I guess on a whole, if Chicago's murder rate continues to go down, then the Chicago Police Department will be able to say, you know, it's programs like this that allowed that to happen. But being able to point specifically to this program and saying, you know, this is what did it, they haven't tried it sufficiently to have any statistical evidence to prove that it works. And it's not clear that they're going to get further support to try it out to its full extent. I mean, again, you know, only 50 out of 400 people have been contacted, and so and they won't talk about any of the people they've contacted, and they won't disclose any of the names on that list.
Are they watching the other 350? Or do you have to be contacted before you're watched?
Nobody knows. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's very much up in the air, and it's very much this partially hypothetical idea.
Is this? I mean, well, let's face it. Online retailers and marketers are using this very technology to predict what we're going to buy online. They know what
right.
they try to predict what books we want to read, what type of lawnmower we want to buy. Is this the future of policing?
I guess it could be, but if it is, then again, there are some major questions that we have to answer. If you're predicting what somebody's going to buy, then maybe you'll be able to target them with an advertisement. If you're predicting that they're going to commit a crime, then there's a possibility you're going to put people in jail. You're going to put people behind bars, and that's a much higher threshold to go beyond. And I think there are a lot more questions that we have to answer before we start comparing what Target does with its data to what police departments do with theirs.
All right. Thank you very much, Matt Stroud, a writer at The Verge. He has written about the new predictive policing system in place in Chicago. Thanks for joining us on Tech Tuesday on All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll look at some of the tech business headlines, and there have been a lot of them the past week or so. That's when Tech Tuesday continues here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It has been a big week or so for the tech business news. Facebook, Candy Crush, Comcast, and Time Warner Cable all made news that involved tens of billions of dollars. And with us now to discuss the latest in the business of technology is Dominic Rush. He is the business reporter with The Guardian. Dominic, welcome to All Sides, Tech Tuesday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. So we'll get to those stories in just a moment, but a big story broke overnight that involved virtual currency. A huge player in the Bitcoin industry has shut down for all intents and purposes. Mt. Gox is based in Japan. Last week, it stopped withdrawals from its Bitcoin system after what it called unusual activity. And now the site has basically disappeared. Its website is gone, leaving just a message. Its Tokyo office is dark, and investors who used real money to buy this internet currency are not happy. Dominic, do we know what's happened to Mt. Gox?
Well, there's been a series of problems with Mt. Gox over the years, and there's been a lot of speculation about what was going to happen with them. At the moment, we're kind of, like the investors, we're all a bit in the dark about exactly what's gone wrong. But it looks like somebody hacked their systems, not for the first time, and some people are speculating that something like 6% of the bitcoins in circulation could now be missing. So it looks like a very serious problem, both for Mt. Gox and for Bitcoin.
So this basically is kind of like a Brinks robbery, perhaps?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's kind of like a run on the bank as well. I mean, apparently there are people in Tokyo outside Mt. Gox's office saying, you know, where's our money, our virtual money? It's kind of strange. Such a strange currency anyway, but this story is getting a little weirder by the minute. At the moment, there's a note up saying that they've taken a decision to close all transactions for the time being. But so we're awaiting developments on this. But it's, you know, the Bitcoin has been desperately trying to go mainstream. The Winklevoss twins, who most famously involved in Facebook, have been involved, and other people are trying to make it more of a mainstream option for people. And news like this is certainly going to put off new investors, I should think.
Dominic Rush is a business correspondent for The Guardian. We're talking about headlines in the tech industry here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Dominic, has there been any indication of a run on other Bitcoin outlets?
Not really. I mean, it seems to be, the Bitcoin itself has crashed, unsurprisingly, but it's an incredibly volatile currency anyway. So it was worth Bitcoin was worth $1,200 back in December. And the last time I looked, they were below $600. So somewhere between $500 and $600. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's a hell of a slide. But this is, like I say, this is an incredibly volatile currency. I mean, you know, not so long ago, bitcoins were worth $200, like last April or something. So they're still kind of high. So there's no reason why it couldn't come back very rapidly if this issue is resolved.
But this can't help. I mean, it also calls to the need of regulation. And if these people lose their money, that's not going to help the Bitcoin brand, so to speak.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, this is all bad news for everyone involved in the Bitcoin Bitcoin world. I mean, recently we had the Silk Road thing where we found out that, you know, the people were using the virtual currency to buy drugs and other illegal stuff online. That didn't help. This isn't going to help either. The idea of making Bitcoin mainstream gets more and more difficult the more that things like this happen.
And other Bitcoin companies are quick to point out that we're safe, we have better security, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And there definitely is some truth in it that Mt. Gox was a problem waiting to happen. Bitcoin has become so huge and so many people are interested in it now. It looks like it just didn't have the systems in place to deal with the volumes of business it was getting. We're going to have to wait and see what happens here. But yeah, this is going to just lead to more and more people asking for more regulation and more adult supervision of this currency.
So even before this, that was my next question. Even before this, there were increasing calls for regulation, and can you regulate this industry?
Well, that's a really interesting question because it's a virtual currency and it's not domiciled anywhere. So who's in charge here? I mean, we've had hearings, Senate hearings about Bitcoin, and in Bernanke was kind of interested in the currency at the time and was not massively negative about it. So I think, you know, there are some mainstream people who are very interested in where we go with virtual currencies. I mean, if you use your phone to buy a coffee in Starbucks using Starbucks coins or whatever, I mean, we're all kind of used to using things that aren't dollar bills anymore. There's some developments here that are really interesting, and Bitcoin is, I think, historically very important. But whether it will end up being the virtual currency that people use around the world, I don't know.
So not quite ready to go onto the Bitcoin standard to value currency quite yet.
No. Can you imagine going into Starbucks and saying, I'm sorry, your Bitcoin's not worth a Starbucks anymore? That would be really annoying.
It'll be interesting to watch. Dominic Rush is U.S. business correspondent for The Guardian. We're talking about headlines in the tech world on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, Facebook used real money, $19 billion, to purchase WhatsApp. Here's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
WhatsApp is on a path to connecting more than a billion people, and there are very few services in the world that can reach that level, and they're all incredibly valuable. So when we had the opportunity to be a part of this journey, I was just really excited to take you on up on that.
Mark Zuckerberg speaking about the purchase of WhatsApp. Dominic Rush, 2 weeks ago, I bet you 95% of us didn't even know what WhatsApp is, and now it's all over the news. What's up with this purchase?
I think WhatsApp's fascinating. There's a shift, I think, happening in social media, in the way people want to communicate. And WhatsApp, I use WhatsApp because I use it to talk to my mum in England and friends in England, because you can use it over wireless and it's free. It's very big in Europe. It's big in Brazil. It's big. We've got 450 million people, and they're heading rapidly towards a billion. That's what Zuckerberg was saying. But it allows you to just have kind of a closed network. So you're not, say, with Twitter or with Facebook, there's this, you're broadcasting in a way. And people seem to want something more intimate. They don't. Twitter seems to be losing its edge, I think, and it's not.
So this is a text communication device, or is this a voice communication device?
Yeah, you can use it. Well, they're talking about adding phone. They're talking about using voice now as well. But at the moment, you send text and pictures, so you could set it up. So say you had, five relatives in Brazil or something that you chatted with, then you would just send. You could send all five of them a photo of your new baby or whatever. Using WhatsApp, and it's free, which is kind of amazing when texting between countries can be expensive, and it's incredibly easy to use. It searches through all your contacts and lets everyone know you're on WhatsApp and everything. It's a very simple, easy piece of technology, which is why it's grown so quickly. Of course, the flip side to it for a company that Facebook bought for $19 billion is that it makes no money whatsoever, and also its founders appear to have no interest whatsoever in making any money. There's no advertising on it.
Isn't that par for the course for a lot of tech companies?
Sure, making no money is fine until it's not, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's what we always see with these companies. It's all about growth until it becomes about making money.
So how does Facebook make money on this? They're spending a lot of money. How does it make money on it?
Well, I wonder with Facebook whether they, take Google as an example. Google bought YouTube, I think, for $1 billion or something, and everyone said that's crazy. And it took them a long time to make some money out of it. But, YouTube's fantastic. Everybody uses YouTube, but YouTube hasn't gone anywhere. So it could take them some time to work out what the business model is. But they're making enough, Facebook makes enough money now to carry things around that, it can take some time developing and finding ways of making cash out of it. And if it genuinely grows to have a billion people using this service, then that's got to be worth something. I mean, whether it's worth $19 billion or not is, I think, an arguable point. But everything's, at the moment, people are paying huge bubble-like prices for things, and not all those bets are going to pay off.
We're talking about tech business headlines here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Dominic Rush is our guest. He's a U.S. business correspondent for The Guardian. Some see this as Facebook's attempt to reconnect with the younger audience that may be drifting away. Why are younger folks moving away from Facebook towards things like WhatsApp?
Well, I think that it's got a bit passé. It's a bit, if your mum and dad and your grandpa and grandma are all on Facebook, then do you really want to be? I mean, I don't know about you. Are you friends with your mum on Facebook? Is that, you want to say, people find it a bit kind of naff, as they say in the UK.
I'm friends, but I'm not getting in trouble that I was when I was younger, so.
well, wait and see. Maybe one day. But I mean, Snapchat. So Snapchat is a service that allows you to send messages and pictures and things that disappear. So there's more privacy to it. So if you are kind of sending slightly risque stuff, of course, you know, disappear is an arguable word because there's always ways of capturing these things. But I think, like I said before, with WhatsApp, it allows you to kind of narrow your broadcast, so you're not sending it out like you are on Twitter to everybody, and you're kind of just you're keeping more control of your message. And I think that's appealing to younger people who don't necessarily want everybody knowing all the stuff they're up to.
Mm-hmm. Facebook messaging has, you know, it's okay, but it hasn't really caught fire. Is this an attempt of Facebook to try to get into that messaging realm and make its messaging service more popular, stronger?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, they've said it's going to run as a separate business, and I'm sure it will. It will run as a separate business. I mean, I think that Facebook is at the moment in the business of buying things that are not just because they're a great addition to their business, or they believe it's a great addition to their business, but also in stopping other people. I mean, there's a Chinese company called WeChat that's a rival to WhatsApp that's huge and is growing quickly over here as well. And, you know, Google were talking to WhatsApp. So, I mean, it must be nice for Facebook to squeeze Google out of that equation. So I think there's a lot of positioning here for whatever's going to be the next big thing.
And this also, this purchase and this app, WhatsApp, and the interest in it and the price paid for it shows that, you know, the tech world doesn't begin and end in Silicon Valley. There's innovation happening around the world and tools being used around the world that we in the States really haven't heard much about.
No, that's very true. I mean, and I've been here for 13, 14 years now, but when I arrived, you know, mobile phones here were just, they were crazy compared to what you saw in Europe. There were these just huge bricks, you know, in Europe we were kind of using all these kind of snazzy little tiny phones. It's like, you know, so I mean, America is sometimes behind the curve in some technologies, which I think Americans find hard to believe. But if you look at the way these messaging services have taken off in Japan and in Korea, they're huge, these social messaging services. And those are big, big markets, and all markets that the technology companies are totally fascinated in, because, you know, more and more of their money comes from overseas.
Dominic Rush is a U.S. business correspondent for The Guardian. We're talking headlines and tech business news here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Let's go back to some old media. Comcast has decided or is trying to buy Time Warner Cable, a big deal in the cable television world. Brought up, it's going to make a huge company, brought up some antitrust concerns. What needs to happen now for this deal to actually go through, Dominic?
Well, I'm fascinated. This is another really fascinating story because, again, like you say, it is old media, but in a way, when it's been totally driven by new media, so all these kind of people, cable cutters as they're called, who are not watching cable TV anymore and just watching all their TV on their laptops or on iPads or whatever, and not taking it from the cable station. So clearly, the cable companies are trying to reposition themselves. And I'm not sure. I mean, Comcast is one of the most politically well-connected companies in the country. I mean, their chief executive regularly plays golf with Barack Obama. They're huge Democrat fundraisers. So I doubt they would have gone for this deal if they didn't believe they were going to get it through. But there's going to have to be some deal, some compromises, I think. And Comcast took over NBC Universal in 2011, I think, and there were some compromises made then as well. But it's going to be fascinating to see whether they can push it through or not.
A few more rounds. He has to lose a few more rounds of golf, perhaps, to the president to get this through.
always lose to the president.
Never hurts. Now, these two companies, they don't really overlap much geographically. So you know, like here in Columbus, we have Time Warner. We don't have Comcast. So the name on our bill might change, but we probably won't see a whole lot when it comes to our set, correct?
I don't know. I'm the same. Well, I'm a Time Warner customer as well, but Comcast has these things. They have caps on broadband. So, I mean, you know, the caps are big, but if you are in a household where you're streaming a movie in one room and, you know, your kids are streaming a movie in another and, you know, somebody's file sharing another, you can hit that cap quite quickly. And
cap on the amount of data coming into your house.
Yeah. And I think that there's a lot of big questions that need to be asked here, because you're basically, by combining the number one and the number two cable companies, you're creating a company that's incredibly powerful and is the gatekeeper to 30 million homes, for not just for your cable TV, but for your internet and for your phone, etc. I mean, what does that mean? There was a deal this week with Netflix. Netflix has in the past complained that Comcast had slowed its transmission speed so that in order to favor Comcast's own video on demand service, which, you know, it seems pretty outrageous, really. If you're all paying an enormous amount for your cable bill and you're getting a shoddy service because they're playing, there's no conclusive proof that this was true, but this was an accusation by Netflix, and now they've struck a deal. Well, what were the terms of that deal? We don't know. It was all done in private and in secret. We don't know how much money was changed hands.
But Netflix has agreed to pay Comcast, correct?
Yeah, they have, but for what? Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't really. I mean, are they improving the network? They haven't told us that. I mean, was it a payment so that Netflix would be delivered at the right speed? I mean, as a customer, shouldn't I have been getting Netflix at the right speed already? There's a lot of big questions that need to be answered about this, and hopefully the FCC is looking at them.
What does this deal mean for the future of cable television? We keep hearing that, you know, video on demand services like Netflix and things like that are the future. What does this deal, does it bring new hope to the cable TV industry, or does it mean that this is the first step in its eventual demise or rapid or significant change?
Well, I mean, I think that the argument for this merger to be done, and I assume the argument that they are making, is that there are all these new players in town. There's the Netflix, and there's Google Fiber. Google has got its own fiber company delivering high-speed internet in a small number of cities across the U.S. All these new entrants are coming in. Young people are not paying for cable TV subscriptions. They're just taking their TV straight off, or they're taking their media straight off the internet. So there's clearly a big shakeout going on there, and this is, I think, one of the historic moments in it. But, you know, none of us have any choice in who provides our cable anyway, do we? I mean, it's not; they're all local monopolies.
We're actually fortunate here in Columbus. We've got a couple companies, three companies, vying for our business, and we've benefited from that. I think, you know, I lived in cities where there's only one, and it's. That's it. Take it or leave it. But now we have three and a dish. So,
well, that's very. You're very lucky. I mean, because I'm in New York, we have Time Warner. That's basically your choice. And I think in the majority of U.S. territories, that's the same case. But you know, I think competition is good for consumers, and I worry that consolidation is could be bad, because it's just we need more choices, not less.
Great. Another reason to hate the cable guy.
Poor cable guy.
Dominic Rush, U.S. business correspondent for The Guardian. Thanks for joining us on Tech Tuesday here on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, Russell Hawley will talk about mobile. Everything's mobile at this conference. We'll talk about mobile phones and mobile everything when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today on Tech Tuesday. The Mobile World Congress is underway in Barcelona, Spain. The annual event showcases the latest devices, accessories, and trends in the mobile industry. And joining us now to discuss the latest news coming out of this conference is Russell Hawley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Russell, welcome to All Sides.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
First, the Mobile World Congress. Is it as gridlocked as our Congress here in Washington?
Well, it certainly can be. One of the things, it's really a twofold show. One side of it is the side that that I talk about more, which is the new devices that are announced and revealed. But like CES in Las Vegas, it's also a chance for larger companies to meet at a central location behind closed doors and kind of talk about the next step beyond what they're announcing.
CES is the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where all the gadgets get shown, not just the phones.
Correct. Those are the two big events when it comes to smartphones right now, when they're not individual events. It's Mobile World Congress and the Consumer Electronics Show.
So you're not there, but you're monitoring it.
I'm at home, thankfully, because Barcelona is quite a way away from me. Yeah. Fortunately, we have editors in the UK who were willing to go out there, and we've been communicating with them constantly. So I am as close to being there as I can be without having hopped on a plane.
Before we get to the specific new gadgets, what are the trends right now that you're seeing in the mobile world, and what are the things being discussed at this Congress?
Well, the two big things that we're seeing from the mobile world in general is wearable technology, whether it's something like Google Glass that you wear on your face or something like a Pebble smartwatch that you wear on your wrist. And the other thing that we're seeing is smartphones that are getting bigger screens and focusing more on unique software as opposed to, kind of bleeding edge hardware.
So bigger screens for smartphones. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I kind of like the size of my iPhone right now. I'm not sure I want anything bigger, but I can see the advantages for some.
So it's really, where in the world you are. There are definitely parts of the world like Korea and China where, the smartphone becomes kind of your all-in-one entertainment device that you can connect to your television and watch TV. And when you're not at home, you can, listen to music and play games, and it becomes kind of your computer. But we've also got places like here in the States where we've already got, kind of our laptop and our entertainment center and things like that. So the smaller phone appeals to that audience. I'm personally a fan of the smaller phone. I use a Moto X instead of an iPhone, and it's just a little tiny bit bigger than an iPhone 5S. But it seems like the entire industry is trending towards these larger screens, and there doesn't seem to be any way to stop it.
Do they still have to fit in a pocket? Is that sort of the outside edge for a phone? Then you get into tablet, I suppose.
Most of them, it's nice if they fit into a pocket, but surprisingly not all of them, especially from Samsung and LG. They've got these monster phones that I genuinely don't believe would fit in my front pocket.
Imagine I suppose you have Bluetooth and everything else, but trying to drive holding that phone, you need two hands. You couldn't keep any hands on the wheels if you're trying to use
phone
in traffic.
Or heaven forbid, having it mounted in your windshield and having it take up a quarter of your windshield.
Russell Hawley is editor at Geek.com. He's a tech blogger at Geek.com, and he joins us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Wearable, there was a story on NPR yesterday. I don't know if you caught it. The reporter had the wearable camera, and it was pinned to her lapel, and it took a camera. It took a picture every 30 seconds. Is that kind of the wearable technology you were talking about, similar to Google Glass?
No. So that fits a separate category that I think is more traditionally referred to as life logging.
Yes.
Where Mimoto cameras and things like that exist to take those pictures and that's a branch of technology that I personally have not really gotten into yet. There's certainly a personal deal of excitement around that, but it's a little unnerving for me, I guess. So it's not something that I've jumped into. When I say wearables, I'm really talking more about something like Google Glass or a smartwatch that sits on your wrist or a fitness band that you attach somewhere else to your body that kind of just it either collects data or presents data in such a way that makes it so that you don't have to reach and grab for your phone.
I see. So let's get to some of these gadgets. The Samsung Galaxy S5 phone. What's up with that?
Samsung has two lines of phones that they keep up with every year. They have the Galaxy S line and the Note line. And the spring is usually the time of the year where they update the Galaxy S line, and that's what we saw this year with the Galaxy S5. It is, again, trending towards a larger screen than the previous version, going from a 4.9-inch screen to a 5.1-inch screen with a faster processor and a new textured back. A big criticism from the Galaxy S4 was that the back was kind of glossy and slippery when you went to hold it. They've replaced the backing entirely with a textured kind of studded back that is, I've been told, feels a whole lot nicer to hold than the plastic version. The Samsung user interface has been completely overhauled. It has a fingerprint scanner that is similar in concept to Apple's Touch ID, but its implementation is more of a swipe gesture as opposed to holding it in one place like Apple does. And in my opinion, that's a mistake because the swipe sensors traditionally don't work as well. But I've yet to touch it to make that a firm decision. And there's also a heart rate monitor on the back of the phone, just below the camera, that works well with the fitness application that Samsung has been working so hard on over the past year.
So what does that tell you? You know, that you need to rest or you're going to having a heart attack? What does the heartbeat sensor do?
Well, so it ties into an application that they call S-Health, and it's something that Samsung's been working on for a while. It's kind of a personal fitness thing. It works with a motion coprocessor to track steps that you make and activities that you are doing throughout the day, and you can now check your pulse to go along with that. It's really just another point of data for the S-Health app to determine how active you are throughout the day. And it uses that to suggest meals or to give you an outlook on how many, what your activity has been like throughout the day so that you can set personal goals and either reach them or not.
It has a special sensor to detect your environment and adjust the screen as well.
This is something that Samsung has been working on for a little while now, where their screens, they use these a technology that they make themselves called Super AMOLED, and it's a display technology that is very color saturated. Things are incredibly bright colors, incredibly deep blacks, almost unrealistically so when you compare them to things like LCD monitors and things like that. But they end up looking very nice on phones. Unfortunately, when you take them out into sunlight or when you're in very dark environments, the display can be either blinding or completely washed out by the sun. So what they've done is add a new sensor that adapts the color patterns and the gamut of the screen to match those environments so that you don't have those problems when you're using them in all of the different scenarios that you would be in throughout the day.
Interesting. Russell Hawley is a tech blogger for Geek.com. He joins us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 292-8513. If you want to jump on the phone and ask a question, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned the wearable technology, the Samsung Gear 2 smartwatch. What's going on with that?
So Samsung technically released three different smartwatches over in Mobile World Congress that each fit three different groups. One appeals more to the original design of the Samsung Galaxy Gear, which was a smartwatch that had its own camera mounted on the wrist. I used the original one and really couldn't ever justify using my wrist to take a picture when I had a phone or something like that. But the Gear 2 Neo is a smartwatch that has the camera built into it. If you don't want the camera option, they offer the Gear 2 with a replaceable wristband that you can put whatever watch band you want on it. And it's really just a slimmer display that grabs notifications from your phone or allows you to hold phone conversations without needing to pull your phone out. And then there's the Gear Fit, which is more of a fitness band, but it has a curved display that goes across your wrist and gives you access to basic notifications. And it includes the same heart rate monitor that is on the back of the Galaxy S5, but it gives the information to the phone in a more real-time fashion because it's constantly on your skin.
We're talking with Russell Hawley, tech blogger for Geek.com here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Russell, maybe we're not quite as hip as other cities, but I frankly have not seen one person using one of these smartwatches or phone watches or wrist phones. Are these things taking off and people buying them?
I think that the idea of using your wrist to make a call is not something that's going to take off anytime soon. I think Samsung's kind of barking up the wrong tree for that one personally. But I also think that the idea of a smartwatch is such that you really wouldn't look and see, you know, hey, that person is using their watch to do something. It really is kind of a glance down mechanism. And they look like normal watches, just with a slightly larger display. And really, it's the kind of thing that's it's designed to be as minimal impact as possible. It saves you, as crazy as this sounds, a lot of people pull their phones out, you know, every minute or so to check and see if they've got a notification, if they're doing something like waiting in line for something or sitting at a stoplight. And that's what the smartwatch idea is replacing that notion, which you know, gives you additional battery life on your phone and things like that.
So are those screens going to get bigger eventually? You know, you talk about the screens on the smartphones getting larger. I can imagine carrying around this big brick on your wrist.
I think that the wrist is one of those places where if they try to go too much bigger than what they've got right now, they're going to run into real problems. But it wouldn't surprise me to see more like the Gear Fit, where instead of having this kind of brick that sits on your wrist, you have a curved display that goes around the contour of your wrist, which gives them more of a display radius but doesn't actually take up more room on your wrist.
We have a call here about mobile, and we'll go to Christopher in Columbus. Go ahead, Christopher. You're on the air with Russell Hawley from Geek.com.
Hi, Mr. Hawley. I am very grateful for you every Tuesday. I think you do a great job, and I enjoy listening to you. My question today is my Android mobile Facebook mobile app is asking to update with an outrageous list of permissions that it wants. And is there any public outcry? Is it at this conference, or is that an issue on the extent of permissions that you're allowing these apps to use? Is that an issue in the public? It doesn't seem like anybody else is terribly concerned about it.
All right. Thanks. Thank you, Christopher. Russell?
We are, unfortunately, a small minority of people who feel like apps like Facebook ask way too much as far as access to our personal information. The only suggestion that I can offer to you right now on the phone that you're using right now is to not update if you're uncomfortable with it. There are Android phones that are being released. That one was released recently, made by a company called Cyanogen Inc. And there was another that was actually announced at Mobile World Congress called the Black Phone that gives Android users control over granting permissions to these applications so that they can continue to use the applications but not give up all of this personal information. But unfortunately, you know, your options right now with phones like the Galaxy and you know, the HTC One and things like that, it's an on or off situation where you can either grant them the permission or you can not use the application. Fortunately, Facebook is one where you cannot use the application, but you can go and use their web interface, and it's not, you know, it's not a totally offensive experience. It's still usable in that fashion. And that's really the recommendation that I would give in that situation.
Yeah, it's particularly concerning when you talked about all the health information you can gather from these, you know, wearable things in these phones now. And, you know, you don't really want to share with Facebook, you know, what your heart rate is at a certain particular point in time and things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, when it comes to Facebook is really the most egregious, in my opinion, asking for these application information. Although there was there have been others in the past. I think most notably, one of the election applications during the most recent election, there was a ton of information that got asked when you signed into that application, and that was really bad form as well. And it's really, you know, it's good now. There used to be a real problem with Google, especially showing what permissions were being asked for. But I think now, especially with the more recent versions of Android, they're way better about making it clear that, you know, the app really wants to see this information about you. And at that point, you can choose to not install the application or to go ahead with it.
You know, we keep hearing that younger folks don't really care about the stuff, that they're more willing to share. But are we reaching a point where even that audience is saying enough is enough?
I think that that's a hard statement to make. I think that there are far more people, regardless of age right now, willing to press that OK button, much in the same way that they blindly agree to terms and conditions when they install things on laptops and you know, other places, as they are to go and read and make that decision. And it's really just because they've already resigned themselves to wanting this thing. They're just pushing the button to get to it as quickly as possible. And there's not an easy solution to that particular problem. Mm-hmm. Educating is difficult if they don't want to listen in the first place.
Right. In the meantime, read every word of those terms and conditions. That's our advice. Russell Hawley, tech blogger with Geek.com. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides with
Ann
Fisher.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson. I've sat in for Ann Fisher. She hopes to be back tomorrow on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.